the best laid plans. "She's a real Botticelli," said the young man dreamily, as he watched the figure of William's sister Ethel disappearing into the distance. William glared at him. "Bottled cherry yourself," he said indignantly. "She can't help having red hair, can she? No more than you can help having big ears." The young man did not resent the insult. He did not even hear it. His eyes were still fixed upon the slim figure in the distance. The young man, James French by name, had met Ethel at a party and had succumbed to her charm. Lacking courage to pursue the acquaintance, he had cultivated the friendship of her small brother, under a quite erroneous impression that this would win him Ethel's good graces. "What would you like most in the world?" he said suddenly, leaning forward from his seat on the top of the gate. "Suppose someone let you choose." "White rats," said William, without a moment's hesitation. The young man was plunged in deep thought. "I've thought of a way," he said at last. "Yes, this is my idea." The young man talked earnestly. William's mouth opened wide. The words "white rats" were repeated frequently. Finally, William nodded his head. "I suppose you're balmy on her," he said, "like what folks are in books. I want 'em with long tails, mind." The next morning, William assumed an expression of shining virtue. "You going shopping this morning?" he inquired politely of Ethel. "You know I am," said Ethel shortly. "Shall I come with you to carry parcels and things?" said William unctuously. Ethel looked at him with sudden suspicion. "What do you want? I'm not going to buy you anything." William looked pained. "I don't want anything. I just want to help you. I just want to carry your parcels for you. I just don't want you to get tired, that's all." "All right." Ethel was still suspicious. "You can come and you can carry parcels, but you won't get a penny out of me." They walked down together to the shops, and William meekly allowed himself to be laden with many parcels. Ethel's grim suspicion became bewilderment as he passed the toy shop without a glance. In imagination, he was already teaching complicated tricks to a pair of white rats. It's awfully decent of you, William," said Ethel at last. "Do you feel all right? I mean, you don't feel ill or anything, do you?" "No," he said absently, then corrected himself hastily. "At least, not just now. I feel as if I might not feel all right soon, but I don't know." Ethel looked anxious. "Well, let's get home quickly. What have you been eating?"
Nothing, said William. I'm all right just now.
They walked in silence till they had left the main road behind and had turned off to the long country road that led to William's house. Then, slowly and deliberately, still clasping his burden of parcels, William sat down on the ground.
"I can't walk any more, Ethel," he said, turning his healthy countenance up to her. "I'm took ill sudden."
She looked down at him impatiently. "Don't be absurd, William. Get up."
"I'm not absurd," he said firmly. "I'm took ill."
"Where do you feel ill?"
"All over," he said guardedly. "I'm took too ill to walk."
She looked round anxiously. "Oh, what are we going to do? It's a quarter of a mile home." At that moment there appeared the figure of a tall young man. He drew nearer and raised his hat. "Anything wrong, Miss Brown?" he said, blushing deeply.
"Just look at William. He says he can't walk, and goodness knows what we're going to do."
The young man bent over William, but avoided meeting his eyes.
"You feeling ill, my little man?" he said cheerfully.
"Huh," snorted William. "That's a nice thing for you to ask when you know you..."
"Yes, yes, yes, all right," he said hastily. "Well, let's see what we can do. Could you get on my back, and then I can carry you home? Give me your parcels. That's right. No, no, Miss Brown, I insist on carrying the parcels. I wouldn't dream of allowing you. Now, William, are we ready?"
William clung on behind, and they set off rather slowly down the road. Ethel was overcome with gratitude.
"Oh, it is kind of you, Mr. French. I don't know what we should have done without you. I do hope he's not fearfully heavy, and I do hope he's not beginning anything infectious."
Mr. French stumbled along unsteadily.
"Oh, no. Oh, no, no," he panted. "Don't mention it. Don't mention it. It's a pleasure. Oh, it really, it is. No, no, he isn't a bit heavy, not a bit. I'm so glad I happened to come by."
The curious little group eventually arrived at the Browns' house. Mrs. Brown saw them from the window and ran to the door.
"Oh, dear," she said, "you've run over him on your motorcycle."
Ethel interrupted indignantly. "Why, Mother, Mr. French has been so kind. I can't think what I'd have done without him. William was taken ill and couldn't walk, and Mr. French has carried him all the way from the other end of the road on his back."
Oh, I'm so sorry. How very kind of you, Mr. French. Do come in and stay to lunch. William, go upstairs to bed at once, and I'll ring up Dr. Ware."
No, said William firmly. "I'm all right now. Honest I am."
"Well, what do you think, Mr. French?" said Mrs. Brown anxiously.
Both Mrs. Brown and Ethel turned to him as to an oracle.
He looks all right, doesn't he? I wouldn't bother. Just don't worry him with questions. I think it's best to let him forget it," he ended weakly.
"Mr. French was splendid," said Ethel. "Simply splendid." Mr. French stayed for lunch and spent the afternoon golfing with Ethel up at the links. And as he walked down the drive much later, with a smile on his lips and his mind flitting among the blissful memories of his afternoon with Ethel, an upper window was opened cautiously and a small head peeped out. Through the still air, the words shot out,
"Two, remember, and with long tails."
"Where did you get it from?" demanded Mr. Brown fiercely.
William pocketed his straying pet.
"A friend gave it me."
"What friend?"
Mr. French, the man what carried me when I was took ill sudden, he gave me it. I didn't know it was going to get into your slipper, and I didn't know it was going to bite your toe. It didn't mean to bite your toe. I expect it thought it was me giving it something to eat. I expect..."
"Be quiet. What on earth did Mr. French give you the confounded thing for?"
I don't know. I expect he just wanted to."
"Now, how many of the wretched pests have you got?"
"They're rats," corrected William. "Whitens. I've only got two."
"Good heavens, he's got two. Where's the other?"
"In the shed."
"Well, keep it outside, you hear? And this savage brute as well."
That night, William obeyed the letter of the law by keeping the rats in the box on his bedroom windowsill. The household was roused in the early hours of the morning by piercing screams from Ethel's room. The more adventurous of the pair, named Rufus, had escaped from the box and descended to Ethel's room by way of the creeper. Ethel awoke suddenly to find it seated on her pillow, softly pawing her hair.
"Where is the wretched animal?"
said Mr. Brown, a few minutes later, looking round with murder in his eyes.
I've got it, Father," piped up William at the back of the crowd. "Ethel didn't understand. It was playing with her. It didn't mean to frighten her.
I told you not to keep them in the house."
"Well, they weren't in the house," said William firmly. "They were outside the window, right on the sill. You can't call outside the window in the house, can you? I put it outside the house. I can't help it coming inside the house when I'm asleep, can I?"
When Mr. French called the next afternoon, he felt that his popularity had declined.
"I can't think why you gave William such dreadful things," Ethel said weakly, lying on the sofa. "I feel quite upset, and my nerves are a wreck, absolutely."
Mr. French worked hard that afternoon and evening to regain his lost ground. In the drive he met William. William was holding a blood-stained handkerchief round his finger.
"It's bit me," he said indignantly. "One of those rats what you gave me's bit me."
Mr. French looked at him apprehensively.
You'd better not tell your mother or sister about your finger. I wouldn't like your sister to be upset any more."
"What'll you give me not to?"
said William. Mr. French plunged his hand into his pocket.
"I'll give you half a crown," he said.
Things went well after that. Mr. French arrived the next morning laden with flowers and grapes. The household unbent towards him. Ethel arranged a day's golfing with him. Glorious vistas opened before William's eyes. He decided that Mr. French must join the family. Life, then, would be an endless succession of half-crowns. The next day was Sunday, and William went to the shed directly after breakfast to continue the teaching of Rufus the dancing rat. The other, now christened Cromwell, was to be taught to be friends with Jumble, William's dog. So far, this training had only reached the point of Cromwell sitting motionless in the cage, while in front of it, William violently restrained the enraged Jumble from murder. Still, William thought if they looked at each other long enough, friendship would grow.
"William, it's time for church."
William groaned. He put Rufus in his pocket and put the cage containing Cromwell on the top of a pile of boxes, leaving Jumble to continue the gaze of friendship from the floor. He walked to church demurely behind his family, one hand clutching his prayer book, the other in his pocket clasping Rufus. He hoped to be able to continue the training during the litany. It was during the hymn that the catastrophe occurred. The Browns occupied the front pew of the church. While the second verse was being sung, the congregation was electrified by the sight of a small, long-tailed white creature appearing suddenly upon Mr. Brown's shoulder. Ethel's scream almost drowned the organ. Mr. Brown put up his hand, and the intruder jumped upon his head and stood there for a second, digging his claws into his victim's scalp. Mr. Brown turned upon his son a purple face that promised future vengeance. The choir turned fascinated eyes upon it, and the hymn died away. William's face was a mask of horror. Rufus next appeared, running along the rim of the pulpit. The vicar grew pale as Rufus approached and climbed up his reading desk. A choir boy quickly grabbed it and retired into the vestry and thence home before his right to its possession could be questioned. William found his voice. "He's took it," he said in a sibilant whisper. "It's mine. He took it." "Shh," said Ethel. "It's mine. It's what Mr. French give me for being took ill that day, you know." "What?" said Ethel, leaning towards him. The hymn was in full swing again now. "He gave it me for being took ill, so's he could come and carry me home, because he was gone on you." "Shush!" hissed Mr. Brown violently.
"I shall never look anyone in the face again," lamented Mrs. Brown on the way home. "William, I don't know how you could."
"Well, it's mine," said William. "That boy'd no business to take it. I didn't mean it to get loose and get on Father's head and scare folks. I meant it to be quiet and stay in my pocket."
Ethel walked along with lips tightly shut. In the distance, walking towards them, was a tall, jaunty figure. It was Mr. French, who, ignorant of what had happened, was coming gaily on to meet them returning from church. As Ethel approached, he raised his hat with a flourish and beamed at her effusively. Ethel walked past him without a glance and with head high, leaving him aghast and despairing, staring after her down the road. William realized the situation. The future half-crowns seemed to vanish away.
Ethel, don't get mad at Mr. French. He only wanted to do something for you, because he was mad on you.
It's horrible, said Ethel. First you bringing that dreadful animal to church, and then I find that he's deceived me and you helped him. I hope Father takes the other rat away.
"He won't," said William. "He never said anything about that. The other's learning to be friends with Jumble in the shed. I say, Ethel, don't be mad at Mr. French. He—"
"Oh, don't talk about him," said Ethel angrily.
William was something of a philosopher.
"Well, I've got the other one left anyway," he said.
They entered the drive and began to walk up to the front door. From the bushes, Jumble dashed out to greet his master. His demeanour held more than ordinary pleasure. It expressed pride and triumph. At his master's feet he laid his proud offering, the mangled remains of Cromwell. William gasped.
"Oh, William," said Ethel.
William assumed an expression of proud, restrained sorrow.
"All right," he said generously. "It's not your fault, really, and it's not Jumble's fault. Perhaps he thought it was what I was trying to teach him to do. It's just no one's fault. We'll have to bury it."
His spirits rose.
"I'll do the burying service out of the prayer book."
He stood still, gazing mournfully down at what was left of Jumble's friend. Jumble stood by it, proud and pleased, looking up with his head on one side and his tail wagging. Sadly, William reviewed the downfall of his hopes. Gone was Mr. French and all he stood for. Gone was Rufus. Gone was Cromwell. He put his hand into his pocket, and it came in contact with the half-crown.
"Well," he said, philosophically, "I've got that left anyway."